Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with two different impressions of President Obama's speech today at the National Defense University, where he called for an end to the endless war on terror. First, Carlos Warner joins us. He is an attorney with the Federal Public Defender of the Northern District of Ohio, who represents 11 Guantanamo prisoners. We will discuss why the president has not closed Guantanamo, which again Obama called for today. Then we will speak with Peter Singer, the director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institution, who was coordinator of the Obama 08 Campaign Defense Policy Task Force. He has an article at the Los Angeles Times, "Finally Obama Breaks His Silence on Drones," which we will discuss along with the president's call to end the perpetual war on terror, which Obama called self-defeating. Then finally, we look into the DOJ and Treasury documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act by Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizen, who served as chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee. He joins us to discuss this new evidence that completely undercuts claims by the Department of Justice that they did not prosecute too big to jail bankers because of a fear that the whole financial system might unravel if some big Wall Street bankers went to jail. And joining us now is Carlos Warner, who is an attorney with the Federal Public Defender of the Northern District of Ohio. He represents 11 Guantanamo prisoners. And tell me, Carlos, what did you think of the president's speech today before the National Defense University? Does it give you some hope and your client some hope?
No, it was unfortunate. I would, on a grade scale, I'd give it a D. And the only reason why it wasn't an F was because he did lift the restriction on transferring individuals to Yemen. But on everything else, it was disappointing. He did not reaffirm his commitment to Article III courts. He did not appoint a high-level official in the White House who can really moderate the fights we've had between the Department of State and the Department of Defense. And he has made no commitment under the current law that exists to transfer individuals, which he has the ultimate power to do so. We heard again from him blaming Congress, and that's simply a misnomer. Congress does not restrict the president from transferring these innocent individuals. And he made no acknowledgement of that whatsoever in the speech today.
You mean that Congress, which controls the purse strings, I mean, it seems most of the speech that he gave was a way to reach out to the public around the Congress to sort of shame them, saying how much it costs, etc. Tell me.
Exactly.
So why isn't, you know, I'm under the impression that the Congress are the ones that refuse to have anybody from Guantanamo in an American prison, and that's just
wrong. Now, there is a restriction to bringing the individuals to the United States. I agree with that. But this is how he says the left. He tells the left that it's Congress's fault, and when he fails to do it, his legacy will be not admitting that he failed to do it, but that Congress blocked him from doing it. Senator Levin, with other courageous senators, inserted into the current version of the NDA waiver authority, the ability for him to transfer individuals if it's in the interest of national security. And again, he underscored today how Guantanamo cuts against national security. And his own review team has unanimously decided that 86 of these individuals should be immediately released. And the solutions are there. So to tell the public we need to have another set of reviews or somehow look at these cases again is just a misnomer. We have the solutions. He has the power to transfer individuals. He doesn't have the political courage to do just that. And I was hoping today that he would demonstrate the political courage to do what's right, and that is transfer these individuals immediately. He made it very clear that he's not willing to do that. Instead, he's going to point fingers at Congress, and he's going to point people within his administration that do not have the power to effectuate change. If he wanted to appoint the right person, he should have done it in the White House. And this is specifically what Senator Feinstein called for. So it's not just me. I believe that senators on the Hill are going to be very disappointed in what he said about Guantanamo today.
So why then did he talk about how American supermax prisons, nobody's ever escaped from them, and recommending that this is where these prisoners go, except for those who can go to Yemen? So to your mind, is he just lying to the American people?
No. Right now there is a restriction that Congress has put on saying that he's not permitted to bring people housed in Guantanamo to the United States either to be held or to be tried. And I agree that has to be changed. But that's less than half of the prisoners there. 86 of the prisoners don't fall into that category. And their problems can be immediately resolved by the president with the stroke of a pen. So again, he's playing politics here. He's looking at the left or at the left and saying it's Congress's fault. And then Congress, already I've seen from Senator Graham, other senators coming out saying that he's soft on terror. This is just politics back and forth like we've seen before. The president doesn't have to engage in this. He has the absolute power to release the 86 men. And he should fight with Congress to bring the remainder to the United States for trial or release. But before we get to that remainder of 80 men, let's deal with the 86 that we all agree that the CIA, that the Department of Defense, everybody agrees should be immediately released. And the solutions have already been constructed by the State Department. He's just reappointing the same individuals. He's talking about starting up the periodic review boards, if you read between the lines of what he said today, and those are ineffectual in closing Guantanamo. His comments today indicate that Guantanamo will be open when he leaves office, unless he makes some real change. And that means that he's got to stick up for what's right. He has to, as some of my colleagues have said, man up, release the people that should be released, and try the rest. He's unwilling to do that, and that was very, very clear by way of his statements today.
So where would he release the 86 to? If they've been cleared, and I understand they have been cleared,
right.
Where does he release them to? Isn't that a problem? A lot of people don't want these people. They've got a bunch of Uyghurs that can't be sent to China. I think they ended up in Bermuda or somewhere ridiculous.
Yes, they did. Now, but the 86, again, the State Department has constructed the solutions, and the solutions are in Saudi Arabia. The solutions may be in Kuwait, although it looks like, from what I'm hearing, Kuwait is falling off the table. The solutions could be in Qatar, obviously in Afghanistan for some of the men, and in Yemen. And I understand that Saudi Arabia is willing to engage with Yemen to help create a rehabilitation center there. And Dan Freed, who was in the State Department, worked very hard to put these solutions together. And it was reported just last week that Hillary Clinton went to the president and said, you need to do these things. You can get the 86 out. And the president's staff was upset at Hillary for presenting the memo instead of doing what's right, which is implementing the solutions. The White House is playing politics with Guantanamo. That has to be very clear.
Well, but aren't the Republicans playing politics too? I mean, Lindsey Graham and John McCain, who Obama beat in 2008, and apparently McCain's never forgiven him for it. They've done everything they can.
Actually, Lindsey Graham's a little bit different. He's up for re-election, but John McCain just last week in the AUMF hearings talked about releasing the 86. So I believe John McCain is for releasing the 86. But the Republicans are not as villainous as one might think. And you're talking to somebody from the left. The Republicans allowed this waiver restriction to go into the NDAA so they could come back and say, wait, you have the authority to release people, but you refuse to do so. And the smart Republicans are saying that, including Senator Graham. Now, they'll still fall into 28%. You know, return to the battle, all these false talking points that they have. But the bottom line is the president could, he on his own executive authority could transfer these individuals now if he wanted to. And his speech today made clear that he's unwilling to do that. He didn't mention his authority. He didn't say he was going to start doing that. He said, we're going to lift the restriction to Yemen and start examining it. And we might do something in the future. And these men are going to get some review. That's empty promises, and they're promises that he's made in the past, and that's what is so frustrating, that we're hearing the same things, those of us that have been close to this problem for many years, over and over again, and frankly, the left shouldn't buy it this time. The right's going to always go for the worst of the worst of housing Guantanamo, even though we know that's false, but the left is the problem here. The left has to say, wait a minute, you're making all this talk, but you're not making action, and we need action, and this is what you could do. Actually, the protester who spoke up, she was right today. 86 men are cleared. You could release them today. Why don't you do it? He didn't answer that question.
No, he did acknowledge the protester and said that she may not be listening to what he has to say, but he certainly agrees with her passion and that Guantanamo is a shame on the United States. It's America's gulag around the world, and it clearly has been an enduring embarrassment. So how did that strike you?
Well, the protester was not only impassioned, she was legally correct.
Right.
And she went, from what I could hear, she said that 86 men are there and you have authority to release them today, and these men are hunger striking and you're not doing that. You're not releasing them. And that's absolutely correct. He has the power to release those 86 today, and it's not about where they can go. The solutions are there. If he started to release the men, some men, the hunger strike would end. Today, 103 men, according to the military, it's more like 130, are hunger striking. And the majority of them are being tube-fed, at least 30 today, but they're being rotated on and off, so likely you have the majority of the men also being tube-fed. And he talked about that and how horrible it was and how we shouldn't leave this for our children. Agreed. But as the president, as the commander-in-chief, you have power already to help the problem, and you are not executing it. And what you're doing is you're listening to the advisors close to you that are telling you this is a bad political risk, that if one of these 86 were to do something bad, you're going to suffer for it, and your constituency is going to suffer for it. And he made the decision not to do what was right. And I mean, honestly, politics took over in the White House. And I know this because I know what's going on in the White House. And it's been reported lately. It's slowly seeping out. But there's people in the White House that don't want Guantanamo closed, that would rather blame it on the right. And unfortunately, clearly, they have the president's ear. And that's very disappointing to those of us who have clients who are dying in Guantanamo.
And the assumption is that that's the advice they're giving, that if there were one of these people were returned and then ended up in a terrorist attack on the United States, well, I think it's a reasonable assumption the Republicans could make hay out of it. I mean, for God's sake, they tried to make hay out of the Sanarovs, these two Chechens up in Boston, by arguing that George Bush, believe it or not, Republicans on the House took to the House floor and said George W. Bush kept us safe and Obama didn't. I guess, you know, conveniently omitting 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, again, and they should be sent straight to Guantanamo. This is, again, the right has done a great job in the media painting Guantanamo as being the worst of the worst. But we know that the majority of the men, according to people in Bush's own administration, were innocent that were taken to Guantanamo. And those are the people that remain there today. So, yes, the right is going to pick up that talking point, and it's so successful, over half left. Half of the people that are Democrats and consider themselves on the left believe Guantanamo should remain open. It's because they don't understand who's in Guantanamo and why we have Guantanamo open. And the president tried to explain this, and that's great to explain it, but he's, again, playing politics. He's trying to convince the left that something's okay, and let's get angry at the right for blocking me from bringing people here when he could solve the majority of the problem. And when I say the majority of the problem, 86 are gone. Today, if he wants to do it, including the Uyghurs. Now, the Uyghurs are a much more difficult case, and he should probably fight, if I was representing the Uyghurs, for them to come to the United States. But that's a whole different scenario. I think many of the Uyghurs would rather be in the places that we're talking about, as opposed to Algeria and some of the other places they try to send them, than in a cell in Guantanamo. So again, I have to underscore to you that the solutions are there. The president's unwilling to employ them, and that's why the speech, from our perspective, gets a D. And I can promise you, on my side of the fence, it was almost unanimous reaction instantaneously. As soon as we saw the speech, everyone who's close to the problem knew what was going on, and that's very disappointing.
Well, again, Carlos Warner, attorney with the Federal Public Defender of the Northern District of Ohio. He represents 11 Guantanamo prisoners. So you mentioned that the polls indicate that most Americans are perfectly happy with Guantanamo, and the even more, I think, telling polls about the use of drones. I think 83% of Americans think drones are a good idea. So why then does the president come out today at the National Defense University and basically say that this perpetual U.S. war on terror, whether through drone strikes or special forces operating with troop deployment, is self-defeating and it has to end?
Well, it has to end, but he doesn't, again, give you any answers about how it's going to end. He wants us to take him at his word that he's not going to use his power in an off way. And he said very clearly again that, you know, his power is absolute when it comes to drones. And, you know, he described about Anwar al-Awlaki and why he had to make that call, but he didn't describe at all about his son that was drone sitting at a cafe, 16-year-old boy. There's no explanation about that and another American citizen, not the two other American citizens, or the fact that the majority of the people that fall victim to drones aren't like Anwar al-Awlaki or some sort of high-level deputy in al-Qaeda, but they're the average foot soldier. And, you know, that's what's disconcerting internationally. Internationally, it's against law. And John McCain, again, said in the AUMF discussion last week, he never envisioned that his vote for the initial AUMF would allow our president today to conduct drone strikes all over the world, in Yemen, Somalia, and this sort of thing. He made a compelling argument about drones. But again, you have to look one layer deeper, and you have to ask yourself, do you want him to have this sort of absolute power? And how is it being executed? And if it is, then let's talk about the way it's been executed in the recent future. I want to hear about Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki. I want to hear about how and why he died. They've never talked about that. I want to hear about why the majority of the men that are killed, men and women that are killed in drone strikes, are the common foot soldier, and where are they killed? These are all secretive operations. The American public has no idea who's killed, how many are being killed. It's basically our word against the word on the ground in where the drone strikes are. You have people on the ground who see a drone strike that say 25 people were killed. Our government says 2 people were killed. There needs to be more transparency. And I think that the president did talk about having more transparency. But let's see. Actions speak louder than words. I want to see how transparent he actually will be with his droning program.
Well, just in closing, Carlos Warner, given that the majority of Americans think Guantanamo is a good idea and 83% think drones are great and the more the bad guys we zap, the better, what percentage was it in it for the president to take the opposite stand today and actually call for the end of the war on terror? He said, this war, like all wars, must end. That's what history advises. That's what our democracy demands. I mean, so why is he doing this if you're saying he's not sincere and he's pulling a fast one on the American left?
Well, look, he's pulling a fast one on the American left on Guantanamo, no question about it. The drone discussion is much more complex, and I'd be the first to admit that. But on Guantanamo specifically, he's clearly pulling a fast one because he can play politics with the issue. So he can talk and talk about all of the American values and how we're going to do what's right, but he's not doing what's right. And I, unfortunately, sense the same thing when it comes to the drone program. So what's his motivation? He wants to say all the right things. But the question is, does he want to do all the right things? And it's when you're president, it's about, he talked about it's a difficult call to make, and he makes it. Well, these are difficult calls to make. They're difficult in a different way because they're political decisions. And sometimes for politicians, political decisions are tougher to make than actually the call to take somebody out. And that's the bottom line. And what I saw today was pure politics, unfortunately, especially on the issue of Guantanamo. There can be no question.
So in other words, he should act more like he did on the gun issue after the kids were killed, that he took on an unpopular subject and took a stand even though he lost.
Well, that's right. That's right. And I'm sorry, and the last comment I'll say is those sorts of issues play into this. I mean, briefly, the reason why Guantanamo, one of the main reasons Guantanamo wasn't closed in 2009 was the Affordable Health Care Act. It's because the political capital is being played elsewhere, and I think that's what's happening today with Guantanamo.
Well, Carlos Warner, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Carlos Warner, who is an attorney with the Federal Public Defender of the Northern District of Ohio. He represents 11 Guantanamo prisoners. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back and get a very different opinion on the president's speech today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Singer, the director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He served as coordinator of the Obama 08 campaign's Defense Policy Task Force and as a consultant for the United States Department of Defense and FBI. He lectures frequently to U.S. military audiences and is the author of several books, including Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution, and Conflict in the 21st Century. His latest article at the Los Angeles Times is, Finally, Obama Breaks His Silence on Drones. Well, it happened. He broke his silence at the National Defense University. And what's your takeaway from it, Peter?
Well, it's interesting, too. You have to judge the speech itself and then the act of giving the speech, which are different things. So the speech itself, I thought it was a very good speech. Now, remember, I'm coming at this as a policy guy, as a policy wonk. This was a very substantive speech. In many ways, the president was not giving a rallying cry. This wasn't one of those soaring emotional speeches. He was really making a case, you know, and it reflected, you know, the professor and lawyer that he's been in the past. I mean, he would lay out a point. He would say, here's the advantages, here's the disadvantages, and then here's where I come down on it as commander-in-chief, given the responsibilities that I have. It was a very meaty speech, a very long speech. I mean, this was an hour-long speech. So, you know, I think it was very effective for that purpose. Now, more important than the speech itself, though, is the act of giving the speech. The president has been caught in a strange irony where he's one of the best communicators of his generation, and yet he's kept quiet largely on one of the key issues that's come to define his administration's foreign policy, maybe even his administration's place in history, and that's the issue of the drone strikes. And there have been, you know, references that he's made in a couple of late-night talk show interviews. His attorney general talked about it. His CIA nominee talked about it. But the president never laid out his case for it, never laid out where he stands on it. And that's very important, not just in thinking about this in public perception, but also inside of government. You know, you have this interagency process, and you have the CIA versus the Pentagon versus the Department of Justice versus the State Department. And essentially, by the president giving the speech, it's the culmination of them working the process to say, this is where we stand on it. And I'm the president, and this is where it goes. And, you know, you can see this, for example, in the way he talked about whether the war on terrorism is over or not, or how much longer it will go. You know, there have been people in his administration in recent weeks who've said everything from, oh, if we, you know, only get 10 to 20 more folks, then this is all over, to others saying this is going to be 10 to 20 more years. He's standing above that and saying, this is where the Obama administration stands on it. And so that's, I think you have to judge it in that manner as well. The very act of giving the speech was important in setting the tone, not just what was in it.
Well, he said, but this war, like all wars, must end. That's what history advises. It's what our democracy demands. So at last, somebody has changed this open-ended global war on terror, where we responded to a hopeless fanatic with an endless war.
Yeah, this was not a speech where he was standing on an aircraft carrier with a big poster saying mission accomplished behind him, nor was this the thing saying, well, it's going to last forever, and you know the fears that people have of, you know, you can do anything anywhere and there's no control of it. Again, he went into pretty deep depth on where he sees the challenge. I mean, here's an example. When he talked about the evolution of al-Qaeda and the terrorist threat, how it's changed since 9/11, you know, he broke it down into categories, fleshed it out with instances, you know, compared the differences between how al-Qaeda prime, the core, has evolved since 9/11 versus the threat from regional organizations versus the threat from homegrown or lone wolf actors. I mean, again, you know, he went, you know, this is not the kind of substance you normally see in presidential speeches. And what he was, in essence, trying to do is strike a balance between saying, look, terrorism is with us for the long term. There's not going to be some kind of victory parade. And yet, the kind of ad hoc structures driven by a lot of short-term thinking that we built up after 9/11. Guantanamo would be a classic example of that. But, you know, whether he openly admits it or not, some of the directions that the drone strike campaign would be also in that. It's him saying we can't have these kind of ad hoc approaches for the long term. That was the balance he was trying to strike. Another way of putting it is that he was trying to make a case for the regularization of a not just post 9/11 counterterrorism strategy, but a post bin Laden counterterrorism strategy.
There was, of course, somebody that wasn't at all silent, and that was the co-founder of Code Pink, Medea Benjamin, who interrupted the president. And when she was dragged out, she said, "Can you tell the Muslim people that their lives are as precious as our lives?" And the president did respond to her at length and said, "I'm willing to cut the young lady who interrupted me some slack because it's worth being passionate about." Then he told the audience, "Guantanamo has become a symbol around the world of an America that flouts the rule of law." So this is, you know, obviously a pretty strong marker he's placing down here. But why can't he close Guantanamo? That's why the protesters are outraged. They assume that the president of the United States can do it. Why can't he do it? He's wanted to do it from day one, apparently, but he can't do it, or he hasn't done it.
Well, let's tackle this in a couple instances. First is kind of the sad thing that's happened with some of these groups, and that even when they've got good points to make, the tactics that they've gone about it have undermined their points. And I think we saw that illustrated today. Look, show some respect. And you have your opportunity, your voice to be heard. I mean, what was funny and sad at the same time about it was, one of these illustrations of America. She pops up, she screams and yells, and president listens, and then she sits back down. Everyone's like, okay, you got it out. Then she pops up again. It's like, come on. And it was one of these things where, again, I think they're undermining the strategy. It's disrespectful. And then the funny, weird thing about it was she's screaming out, "Close Guantanamo," in the very midst of the sentence where he's saying, "And this is how I want to close Guantanamo." And then you get into the second part of the question you asked, which is the political realism of this. And it's understanding that, guess what, protesters, guess what, rest of world, we don't live in a dictatorship. There is this thing known as the three branches of our government. And so even when the president might want to close it down, there's this other thing known as Congress. And so this is one kind of an unrealism on their part of thinking, snap your finger, it's going nuts. I bet he wishes he had that power. But the other part of it is the question of how do we judge this speech and this strategy? The speech itself, Professor Obama would probably, give a very good grade to it. But strategy is different. Strategy has to be judged by its implementation and by how it survives, as the German military historians would say it, first contact with the enemy. You might have the best strategy in the world, but after it has contact with the enemy, that's really how you can judge it. And the enemy in this case, so to speak, is everything from the terrorists themselves to the enemy and the plan and the strategy to shut down Guantanamo is the other branch of government, is Congress, which has resisted it. And that's where you saw the president doing a couple of things. He was laying out his case not just from a right and wrong issue, saying, I don't think this is a right thing. It's contrary to our laws. The Supreme Court has found, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He was also saying, look, you've been willing to let me carry out a fairly active counterterrorism campaign. I think I've proven my bona fides. I've gotten bin Laden, et cetera. Well, I'm telling you, Guantanamo is not helping. It's harming my counterterrorism strategy. So he's making that kind of argument. Then he's trying to appeal to something else that Congress traditionally cares about, which is money, saying we spend $1 million a year per prisoner. And on top of that, we have this request to spend almost $250 million more on upgrades to this prison that I and my past opponents in Republican presidential campaigns have both said is not good for the nation. And oh, by the way, it's at the same time that the budgets for everything from the Pentagon itself to school lunch programs are being cut. So, you know, he's in essence making an investment-based approach of saying there's arguably no worse investment we could make than spending $1 million a year on prisoners in Gitmo. So, you know, that's what he's arguing. But again, that argument hasn't fully worked in the past. We'll see how it plays out in the coming weeks with Congress. Some of the other things he offered up, a couple of them were symbolic, like saying, oh, I'm going to appoint a high-level official to supervise this. You know, that's more symbolism than, you know, really able to drive substance. There were other parts that may be a little bit more substantive down in the weeds. For example, him saying, I'm going to re-examine the process of everything from how to do military commissions back in the United States at a U.S. military facility to looking at how to send more prisoners back, including reopening up Yemen as a potential destination. And that opens up a wider set. So these are kind of down in the weeds things, but bottom line, the Gitmo part of the strategy is going to be harder for him to implement than the drone part of the strategy.
But isn't it pretty clear that the majority of the American people, I believe it's up to 80%, are quite happy to have the president use drones anywhere and everywhere, and they've given him a blank check. It is only a minority of the country that is outraged by both the moral implications of what's happening and also, I suppose, to a lesser extent, the geopolitical implications, because after all, the war on terror has been in many ways a blank check to the Assads and the Mugabes and all of the dictators around the world, particularly when it came to torture during the Bush-Cheney era, where every two-bit dictator in the world can say, well, you know, the Americans torture, so what's the problem? So I think we paid a price. And if it wasn't for the Medea Benjamins of this world, do you think the president would be acting? In other words, nobody's pushing him. The majority of the people are in favor of the use of drones and are happy to keep Guantanamo open. I mean, I'm accurate in that, aren't I?
I'm going to agree with you on one part and disagree with you on another part. So the disagree part is, no, I don't think someone popping up and screaming is what drove the president of the United States to give this speech, oddly enough, at the very same place the person popped up in the speech. I don't think that's what drove it. I think it's the realization that this is, and regardless of the polling and the policy world, there is the realization that a series of ad hoc measures, be it Gitmo, be it the way they've gone about some of the drone strikes, they've come with long-term questions, long-term consequences, and what we were doing in an ad hoc manner was not sustainable. I don't think that's something that claiming that, you know, I don't think Code Peak can claim success by any means for driving that discussion. Just, it would be unfactual. Where I would agree with you is the broader part of understanding that every action comes with consequences, first, second, third order consequences. And an example of that would be, you know, whether it was the torture debate or drones or whatever, that you may do something thinking that you're doing it for the right reason, but it opens up a series of cans of worms. I think, you know, one of the ways the president talked about it was that sometimes whether something can be argued as legal doesn't make it smart. And that would be I think that would apply to, you know, for example, let's go back to the Bush years, the way they would bend over backwards arguing that things were legal, and we could go back and forth on, you know, whether it was true or not, but we could agree that it had consequences that were not smart for us. And again, it's not just looking inside of constitutional discussions. It's also the way that other governments take our precedents, take the way we operate, and then either model after it or even misuse our precedents to legitimate what they're doing. And I think that's one of the other aspects of audience here that matters, the audience that mattered in this speech. You know, while in the U.S. we like to think about things in terms of the domestic poll numbers, like you referenced, the two audiences that mattered way more, one was, as I mentioned, inside government, the president staking out to the interagency where it's going to be. And the second is internationally, where as these technologies proliferate, like drones, and as our allies keep coming back to us and saying, we need you to resolve these situations. We can't cooperate with you on counterterrorism in the way that we might want because of Gitmo, because of some of the things that are happening on the drone side. Basically, it's the international side of this matters as much, where the president, by laying out a broader strategic approach that, you know, I would argue is a lot more sensible than maybe where we were 10 years ago, what he's trying also to do is rebuild that coalition on the international level.
But in terms of the interagency, what flexibility and what power does he have to make unilateral decisions? You're saying that
in the interagency, the president has the power. You know, to the funny thing here is this speech. The president, you know, we judge presidential speeches by the, you know, Reagan-esque communicator, but it's more, you know, this one will thrive or fail dependent on his role in the decider side, sort of to echo the Bush side. So in the interagency, at the top of the executive branch, he's got that. The problem, which again the protesters don't seem to get, is that there's these other branches of government that are not part of the interagency. So, you know, guess what? There's certain members of Congress that he may say, I think Gitmo is a waste of money. I think it's a harm to national security. And these are the ways that we might solve it. But the president doesn't, for example, own the checkbook. Congress does.
So when the president says then that this perpetual war, the U.S. war on terror, whether through drone strikes or special forces operations or troop deployments, would be self-defeating, how does he get that message then to this incredibly hostile Congress? You're suggesting here that he's trying to make pragmatic as opposed to moral arguments here.
I think he's trying to hit on, I'm not saying he's doing or. I think he's trying to hit on all levels. Again, right. when he talks about something like Gitmo, he's referencing everything from counterterrorism strategy to he doesn't think it lives up to our ideals, which is a moral value type judgment, to then he makes legal references about the inability to utilize certain systems there versus how the civilian law system has continually worked for, as he put it, in many situations, even worse terrorists. And then he's making just a bottom line checkbook argument saying, I don't think the investment of $1 million a year per prisoner is really all that a great investment. So he's trying to tackle it on multiple levels. Will that work with a Congress that has, you know, been fairly intransigent? I don't know.
Well, just in closing, surely I think this not only isn't an intransigent Congress, this is a Congress that hates this man and doesn't want to give him any kind of victory. So at the end of the day, do you think the protesters should turn their ire on the Republicans, who are really responsible for keeping Guantanamo open?
I think they've done that. I mean, I've been at congressional hearings where they popped up and did the same screaming. That's kind of the problem of when you when you scream at everyone. It's really not you start to get ignored. Again, and let me be clear: there's a difference between protest and some of the silliness that's happened here. So that's my own take. I mean, you have a broader question, which is I'm still confused as to how this happened. You know, this was not a speech like at a university. This was a speech at National Defense University, which is a military base. So, you know, this wasn't like walking off the street kind of situation. I'm sure we'll have a lot of, you know, news stories focusing on how did this play out. But, and that's, you know, let me go back to where we were at the start. This was a strategic speech. This was a substantive speech. This was not a speech about the optics. This was not a speech about soaring rhetoric. And so I hope we take it in that way and then also don't get distracted by some of the silliness that played out. So, for example, you know, there was this scrum of media gathered around the one person being dragged out where literally you couldn't see the person because of all the iPhones trying to take pictures of them. And that's, you know, that's what the media is going to do. But the point is we just listened to an hour-long case laid out for the future of American counterterrorism. Let's wrestle with that.
Well, Peter Singer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
All right, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Singer, who's the director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings Institution. He served as coordinator of the Obama 08 campaign's Defense Policy Task Force and as a consultant for the United States Department of Defense and the FBI. He lectures frequently to U.S. military audiences and is the author of several books, including Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution, and Conflict in the 21st Century. His latest article at the Los Angeles Times is, Finally, Obama Breaks His Silence on Drones. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about new evidence that undercuts the Department of Justice claims that some bankers are too big to jail.
The peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair meant for leather, each of them bigger than all men put together. Sluggers and muggers, wearing fancy gold.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bartlett Naylor.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And I believe that you and Public Citizen have, under the Freedom of Information Act, have extracted some documents from the Justice Department, which completely undercut the DOJ's argument that they've been putting out for why they didn't go after the biggest banks in 2008 and why none of the so-called banksters have gone to jail. So tell us about what you got and how you got them and what they tell us.
And yes, if you'll allow, let's go back a few months. In December of 2012, the Justice Department said that they have found that HSBC, that's the world's third largest bank, had violated criminal violations of anti-money laundering laws involving $200 trillion worth of transactions. That's T as in too big to fail. Trillion dollars. Again, money laundering is how the Sinaloa cartel, you know, gets its money back into the bank accounts. It's how terrorists get funding when they do overseas terrorism, et cetera. But rather than a criminal indictment of the bank or actual individuals, they basically charged them a fine equal to 5 weeks of annual profit. Why? Why not send them, send individuals to jail or literally indict the company? It was too big to jail. That led Attorney General Holder to expand in January, a month of reflection on this, in which he affirmed that problem, that sometimes banks are too big, that if you prosecute them, it will send financial tsunamis through the world economy. Public Citizen, and I think the rest of America, was outraged. And among the things we did was to demand, under the Freedom of Information Act, documents from all of the agencies, including the United States Treasury, as to how it was that you came to decide that you could not, that justice could not prosecute the bank because it was, quote, too big to jail. And those are the documents that you're referring to. They are internal emails and memoranda within Treasury talking about, well, this case. And just to summarize, none of the documents explain the critical question, namely they can't prosecute for fear of economic calamity. They are all about spin, and let's come up with a settlement fast so this New York state prosecutor doesn't, you know, get ahead of us. Let's manage the situation.
But this also surely relates to the Frontline documentary that was, I think, a very, very powerful piece of work, where they did an investigation into the crash and why of 2008 and why no serious person on Wall Street has gone to jail. And in fact, they've all been rewarded by the taxpayer. And now they're even now too bigger to fail. They've even gotten bigger, richer, and more arrogant. And the excuse that came on camera on any number of occasions from Lenny Brewer, who was then with the Justice Department and now has gone back to Wall Street, his excuse, which he kept repeating about why they hadn't put anybody in jail, is the very same excuse, which is that if we go after these big banks, it may have this terrible effect on the entire economy, and we can't take that risk. That was challenged, of course, the absurdity of that was challenged within the documentary itself. Have we learned now that, in fact, he was lying, or at least he was making stuff up?
Whoever said it was too big to jail remains a mystery. Treasury, the Federal Reserve, the controller of the currency, which oversees national banks, all deny that they told Justice that the bank was too big to jail. The only person, the only entity that did say that, and Lanny Brewer has said so in a speech, the only entity that did say that HSBC was too big to jail was HSBC. Defendants in potential prosecutions are allowed to make presentations, and they do. And HSBC made, according to Lanny Brewer, a persuasive case that HSBC was too big to jail. If you'll allow, Holder, the Attorney General, has been much criticized for announcing or admitting that there is a too-big-to-jail policy, that is to say, unequal justice. Small-time money launderers can be sent to jail. There is a woman, for example, the week after HSBC, named Karen Gasparian, who failed to fill out the forms for $8 million worth of transactions. That's compared to the $200 trillion of HSBC. She got 5 years in prison after the Justice Department. But again, HSBC got essentially nothing, a library fine. So Eric Holder, the Attorney General, has been much under pressure to explain this. And so finally, May 15th, I think, he claimed to disavow too big to jail, and he said, and I am quoting, "Let me be very, very, very clear." That's three varies, by the way. "Let me be very, very, very clear. Banks are not too big to jail. If we find a bank or a financial institution that has done something wrong, if we can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, those cases will be brought." That is a direct quotation. Let me just burden you with one other comment. In the December 12th statement of fact, the Department of Justice said, again, they did something wrong. $200 trillion worth of money laundering. $200 trillion. I think that's something wrong. And they also said, if this matter were to proceed to trial, the department would prove beyond a reasonable doubt, by admissible evidence, the facts alleged. Let me just repeat. Holder says, if we can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, the cases will be brought. Well, in December they said, if the department would prove beyond a reasonable doubt if something was wrong. So I don't think we have a very, very clear policy, I think, or at least a very, very clear intention to prosecute banks that are too big. It's very, very clear that we do not.
So Wednesday, there were hearings before the House Financial Services Committee, and I take it, did you provide the committee with these documents?
Yes, they've got them, and they also have some other letters from various regulators that I think affirm that that there really is not a rigorous examination of these banks. There's just an assumption that we can't bring the full weight of accountability to the largest banks. By the way, I think we also learned something that, Ian, if ever you get into really bad trouble and you have to go public and have somebody explain or at least avoid all the important questions, choose this woman named Ramal, who is the current replacement for Lanny Brewer. For 3 hours, she successfully added absolutely no new information into what the Justice Department's too-big-to-jail policy is or is not. And she did it with such charm and skill. So again...
So she wins an Academy Award for obfuscation, is that what you're saying?
Yes, and she had 40 House members. She was sitting still, so they could, you know, they were trying to land a punch, and after 3 hours, and she didn't move, not one was landed.
So this is Mylithi Raman, Acting Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division?
Yes, that's right.
So what's happening on the Senate side? Because you've got, you know, Elizabeth Warren over there who's been fighting the good fight, Sherrod Brown, Jeff Merkley, and Carl Levin, and you also got Patrick McHenry on the Republican side.
Yes, I think whereas too big to fail, or at least the Dodd-Frank response to that, suffers from partisan wrangling, with the Democrats generally favoring the Dodd-Frank ideas and the Republicans generally not. Answering too big to jail, I think, enjoys universal bipartisan support. So you named a number of Senate Democrats who are concerned. You named one House Republican. We've been speaking to a number of Senate Republicans as well who not only share the concern, the question has gotten down to the brass tacks of how we fix this, and ideally there'll be some progress on that in the next weeks and months, because at the very least, transparency into momentous judicial decisions such as this is something that America clearly deserves.
But my understanding is that the Republicans are basically, at the behest of the banking lobby, are trying to kill Dodd-Frank, or at least castrate it, and that recently they won a victory in an effort to regulate derivatives, this vast, opaque market of how many trillion? Someone says it's like 700.
Yeah, 700 trillion.
700 trillion. And the banking lobby won, right?
Yes, it's a battle, not the war. They won in on the swap, the derivatives. I call it swaps. These are bets, and as you say, it's a $700 trillion betting market. They won votes in the House Agriculture, and then last week, is 2 weeks ago, in the House Financial Services Committee. Just parenthetically and regrettably, a number of junior House Democrats joined with the unanimous Republicans on that committee to vote to deregulate this swap gambling market. That has not gone to the House floor. It may well do in June, and unfortunately, passage has to be predicted as likely. But it, of course, has to go through a democratically controlled Senate, and I choose to believe that there is enough enlightened senators to stop that.
And, of course, the reason that the Agriculture Committee is involved is that they have oversight over the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission, who, in turn, are supposed to regulate futures. And this is the great scandal, to my mind, Bartlett Naylor, that the American consumer is just getting gouged, putting food on the table and gas in the tank, because the CTFC simply isn't able, because of lawsuits and because of the banking lobby buying off the Congress, they're not able to regulate, essentially, the futures market. And what you have now is enormous amounts of money coming out of the stock exchange, out of other areas where normally people put money. And it's a huge, huge market now, these indexes that are actually called the Goldman Sachs Index, which just pours enormous amounts of money into commodities, to the extent that those airlines, for example, who want to have a rational price for gasoline because they use kerosene, the end users are screaming The American Bakers Association recently was screaming about, you know, regulate these markets because it's driving up the price of grains to the point where we're going broke. Does the American people know how much they're being gouged by these speculators who bring nothing to the table but just rip off a whole bunch of money, absolute parasites, and end up costing the American consumer enormous amount extra money, both in terms of what they put on the food they put on the table and gas they put in the tank?
And it's most obvious, I think, apparent in the fluctuations in gas prices that go from $3 to $4 and back to $3 when, if the laws of supply and demand truly prevailed, that would have meant the economy went into overdrive for 3 months and needed all that gas and then suddenly, you know, went down by 50%. But it's not. Clearly, when markets are doing that, something artificial is happening. There is a very good case that is manipulation that takes place in energy futures markets by which major players, and we're talking Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, are the beneficiaries.
And you've got to repeat that. Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan are the beneficiaries.
Yeah, they are the large banks. You know, there are four or five banks that control the swaps market, where energy manipulation is manifest at the gas station, where you see prices going from $3 to $4 and back down to $3 and so forth. And they're able to do this through the complexities of derivatives markets and their sheer power and mathematical skill in doing this. We've got a complete mismatch, not only in Wall Street owning Washington, where Wall Street spends roughly $2 million a day lobbying through its roughly 3,000 lobbyists, but you also have them effectively lobbying the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, both directly, vicariously, through members of Congress, et cetera.
And the beneficiaries are basically the big banks, J.P. Morgan,
yes.
Chase, the very people we're talking about that are too big to jail.
And macroeconomically, the consumer spends less on certain products because we've gotten more efficient making them. We used to spend 18% of every dollar on food about 30 years ago. It's now down to 14%. We're certainly not eating less. But we've gone from spending 4% of our average dollar on financial products to 8%. Now, any industry that's getting better and more efficient should show up as taking less of your dollar. Well, Wall Street is taking more of our dollar.
Well, Bartlett Naylor, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who's the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the United States Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Garino. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.